Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, July 30th, 2014, and this is a special radio-only edition of KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly analysis of media behavior comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Mike McKean, sitting in for Amy Simons. Joining me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Esther Thorson, our Associate Dean for Graduate Studies, and Rod Gillette, the creator and longtime host of Views and an emeritus professor in broadcast news. On our agenda this week, the New York Times calls on the federal government to let the states decide whether to legalize marijuana. The annual newsroom numbers for newspapers, radio, and TV are out. They show very modest gains for women and minorities. The billionaire who launched a promising online news company is publicly altering his plans just a bit. The news site best known for its listicles has fired a writer for plagiarism. An ESPN analyst gets a slap on the wrist for saying women should be careful not to provoke athletes into domestic violence. Sarah Palin has launched her own online news site, and an Ohio newspaper gets more than it bargained for by inviting a right-wing rock god to play at its summer barbecue. Let's start with the decision by the New York Times to publish not one, but six editorials this week calling on the federal government to lift its ban on the possession and sale of marijuana. The paper is calling the series High Time. It's full of background information, photos, animations, videos, timelines. And to be clear, the Times is arguing that the states should decide whether to legalize pot. But the editorial writers make it clear they think federal law is out of step with public opinion, that weed is less dangerous than alcohol or tobacco, and that the criminal penalties disproportionately affect young black men. Well, let's get your initial reaction, both of you, and we'll start with Esther, to this decision and the way it's being played out so far in both print and online.
Well, I think the coverage is the usual New York Times good depth, lots of accurate facts, and so on and so forth. But I honestly and somewhat cynically have to think it's a marketing ploy. Because, you know, they're making every effort to appeal to young people. And I think some genius there must have decided that this was the way to do it, to look cool and, you know, forward thinking and so on and so forth.
I don't know if you're as cynical as Esther is, Rod, but it is interesting that they did decide to do this over a period of an entire week with all kinds of interactive elements, which I guess you say would appeal to a younger or at least more net savvy generation.
Well, I'm usually cynical about almost anything. And with regard to this subject, however, for one thing, I'm kind of interested in the play on words here. You're referring to it as the New York Times calling for leaving this whole decision as to whether to legalize marijuana up to the states. It's also been described as New York Times in favor of repealing federal law against marijuana. So I guess it's... Both descriptions are correct. It's also been described as a kind of a momentous decision, history-making. And then the cynics are reacting to that by saying there's nothing momentous about this. Other people, other media have been in favor of this for a very long time. Why has it taken the New York Times this many years to finally get on the bandwagon and call for the repeal of the federal law and leaving it all to the states?
Well, let's pursue that a little bit. I mean, Esther, there are proponents of marijuana reform who agree with the Times editorial opinion that are saying that, oh, the Times is taking this big leadership role. One writer we have up on our blog compared it to Walter Cronkite coming out against the Vietnam War. Is it that significant?
Well, I think every little bit helps in terms of reforming the way we deal with marijuana in the United States, and certainly the issue of so many people incarcerated because of their use of marijuana is just a major problem. Is it momentous? Is it cutting edge? I think clearly not. The New York Times doesn't usually do something like this when they take an editorial stand, just like blow it way all out of proportion. So that just leads me to believe that essentially it's a okay thing to do. Should we salute the New York Times for being cutting edge and leading society? Not a bit of it.
You know, Rod, I mean, I will say this much. I tend to be a little bit cynical about it, too. But the Times figured they were going to get an awful lot of attention with this piece. In fact, they even had Andrew Rosenthal, who is the executive editor of the editorial page, I think that's his title, writing a separate piece sort of justifying why they were doing this. And he pretty much put it on the peg of, we're really concerned about the impact that this law is having on young black men disproportionately, and even essentially said federal law was racist. And so they think that a lot of people are watching, and clearly the White House was watching. We posted a piece there where they're arguing that, sure, maybe the criminal justice laws need to be changed a little bit because of this problem with disproportionate sentencing. But, hey, wait a minute, marijuana has all kinds of dangerous health outcomes. So people are paying attention because the New York Times is writing about it.
Well, I think that's probably one of the motives of the New York Times. We are in a position, because we're the greatest newspaper in the United States, so to speak, we are in a position to lead public opinion on something like this. And therefore, if we, the New York Times, says this, it's going to cause people to pay some attention to what's going on. Maybe this will be, quote, history-making, in the sense that this may be the tipping of the iceberg. And that is, we're at a point now in legalization of marijuana, either for medical purposes or just for leisurely use around the United States, that what is required now is to take away the federal ban and let the states move ahead with this. And we are in a position where we're opinion leaders and opinion molders, that we can do something historically significant in this movement.
And I mean, you could also argue, Esther, that editorials have really never made that much difference in terms of political issues, and now even less so, that if you look at the legalization efforts successful in Washington State and Colorado, that really that had a lot less to do with the news media than just either a change in public opinion generally or other people making very savvy use of non-news vehicles to tell their story.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I have a hypothesis about that, and that is that the New York Times is having its effect on the policymaker level, on the movers and shakers. For the ordinary American walking down the street, particularly young Americans walking down the street, I imagine they don't know a thing about it. Mm-hmm. You know, because, I mean, and that's, you know, it's important to say that that's the way change occurs, by affecting, you know, that top end of the policymakers and opinion makers. But on the other hand, is it going to help them become symbolic of youth and, you know, where you really want to be looking to get your news and those kinds of things? As we know, they're really making this tremendous effort to get young people to go online to read the Times, right? The light form of the Times, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just got to be connected to that effort. And I suspect it's not working in that way.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, because whatever the actual motivation was, at least the context behind this editorial story was another set of numbers released this week by the New York Times, and that's just that their profits are way down. I mean, even though digital subscriptions are up, that's a good thing, there are higher costs, and there's obviously they're losing a lot of money from traditional advertising, and so profits for the second quarter of this year were down more than 50%. So what's more important in those two things that they reported, that the current profit picture is not so good, or that people are starting to pay to subscribe to the digital content?
Well, I have some bias here, and it's really based on the research that Mike Jenner and I have been doing over the last 6 months or so. I think newspapers all decided, with the leadership of the New York Times, that what they needed to do was charge for online access. And the New York Times did a pretty good job with that. Most newspapers in the United States, I think 75% of them now, have gone to a pay model for online. And they thought that was going to solve their problems, as did the New York Times. But the reality is, when 80% of your revenues have come from advertising, simply getting people to pay a couple of hundred bucks to get online access is just not going to make up for that difference. And so this quarter's report from the New York Times is, I think, verification that this reliance on people paying the bills is not going to work.
Well, Rod, we also had some other interesting numbers come out this week. You know, each summer we have the professional organizations that support the newspaper industry and broadcast journalism, and they come out with their annual surveys of newsroom employment. And it's really kind of hard to see much positive news from the print side. I mean, there were 1,300 fewer jobs than there were last year. Maybe a tiny uptick in minority hiring. If you look at the Radio TV Digital News Association, which has done the same thing for television and radio newsrooms for many, many years, they found perhaps a slightly better view of minority employment, although still, even though the numbers are fairly high in historical terms, they're not high in overall terms compared to, you know, the population of minorities in this country. So what do you make when you see those two sets of numbers from the newspaper industry and the broadcast industry this summer?
Well, in terms of the broadcast industry and the minority hiring figure, that's on a national basis. If you look at the regional breakdown, you're going to find a higher percentage of minorities employed in the radio and television industries in their larger markets, which is kind of expected.
Right.
And in those parts of the country where there are fewer minorities, then obviously you have fewer minorities working in radio and TV. But on a national basis, the numbers are up slightly.
Right.
But again, very slightly. And I guess you have to ask yourself, what would be the ideal percentage? I don't know what the ideal percentage would be. Would it have to be reflective of the percentage of minorities in the whole population? Like if you got 11% African Americans working are in the percentage of the population in the United States, should there then be a 11% percentage of employees in the industry from the minority?
Well, that's an interesting point, Rod, because American Society of News Editors, whose report just came out, that has been their goal. So right now, I think total minorities in the United States are like 38%, something like that, and they're expected to go up to 40% very quickly. And that has been their goal since 1978 when they started running the study.
Right.
And what's interesting, and which was not reported in their report, was that since 1978, the percent minorities in the newsrooms they've measured has varied between 12% and 14%.
Right.
It's just been flat as a pancake. So the fact that it's up or down 2 or 3 percents of a point is just – it's nonsense, right? It's basically
right.
been flat since 1978.
And it's the same on the broadcast side too. I mean the total percentage of minority employees is a little higher than the newspapers, but it hasn't changed much in 30 years. Now on the other aspect, they're also measuring how women are doing in the newsrooms. And I notice that both – organizations, ASNE and RTDNA, try to play up in their lead paragraphs or their headlines whatever positive they can pull from this. So, for example, ASNE says 63% of newspapers have at least one woman among their top three editors. Or RTDNA says that they have a third of TV news directors are now women, and that's an all-time high.
That's what we call playing with statistics,
yeah.
Right?
Right. But it still suggests that if those numbers matter, there's a long way to go. And I guess we always have this argument about whether those numbers by themselves really matter, as opposed to whether or not the content of these news organizations is actually relevant to those audiences.
These surveys always refer to the workforce in the newsrooms. I'm curious to know what they include in the workforce. Are we talking now about reporters, editors, videographers, cameramen? We're not getting into what I'll call the ancillary divisions of a news operation.
Well, I don't know about for the broadcast, but I'm happy to say that for the last 3 years, our research center, our survey center here at in the School of Journalism has run that ASNE study. And for them, they ask the leadership at the newspaper to report really everybody that does anything having to do with the
right.
news.
Yeah.
So that'd be online, print, it would be editors, it would be reporters, etc. And so they really are talking about news professionals.
Yeah.
In the news or in the newspaper newsrooms.
And just to be transparent, we've been doing it for the past 3 years here. We won't be doing it any longer. And so now the newspaper industry is going to have to find somebody else to do it, or at least that's what they're reporting.
I stand corrected on that. Actually, unfortunately, we had to close down our survey research center because the days of phoning people to find out things, I think, may be numbered.
Very hard to do these days.
Let me raise a question, if I might, here. Why is this even important? What is it that we are trying to achieve by increasing the diversity, let's say, of the newsroom? It's not just we're going to hire more people. There's got to be a reason.
I think it's a proxy. You'd like to think it would be a proxy for whether or not we are covering stories that are of relevance to minority communities or to women, or we're covering stories that, you know, otherwise are not getting the attention they deserve. I'm not sure that these numbers have any real correlation to that. We can argue about it.
Research indicates that those numbers are important. Yeah. That there have been a lot of studies to look and see how well communities are covered. And if you have, when you have communities where there is a Caucasian dominance in those newsrooms, then there are just a whole lot of aspects of that community that never get covered. So, I think it's very important to look at that. And it's not just stories. It's the framing of the stories.
Well, let's move on to a couple of other – in fact, we have several other items we're probably going to spend a little less time on, but I wanted to cover them at least briefly. Our industry has been looking, as you all know, for new blood to find out ways to dig out of these holes that traditional news organizations have dug for themselves. I think, for example, of Jeff Bezos of Amazon buying the Washington Post, or Berkshire Hathaway's Warren Buffett investing in a lot of smaller papers. And observers have been paying particular attention of late to First Look Media, which is a web-only company that was started by eBay founder Pierre Omidyar. He hired Glenn Greenwald, as you may recall. He recently hired Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone. Well, he came out this week with a 9-month progress report. And he says that First Look has hired 25 journalists. That doesn't sound like a lot. Maybe they'll double that number by the end of the year. But rather than put out a bunch of new online magazine titles, as he said they were going to do, and then aggregate all the best of this stuff online in one place we could all go to, now he's changing things. He's saying, well, really what we want to do is stay in startup mode for a couple of more years. We want to get to understand specific communities that we're trying to target and know how we can serve them better. So I'm just wondering, you know, does this seem to you, when they talk about this real-time journalism lab, as some people describe it, that sounds pretty good on the surface, but I wonder too, Esther, if it doesn't sound like maybe an admission that these technology titans like him and like Jeff Bezos maybe haven't found any better ways yet to save journalism than all the traditional media folks have been trying for the past 10 years or so.
Well, that is interesting. I mean, one would think from the way this announcement was made that there was some acknowledgement that it wasn't quite as easy as they thought it was going to be.
Right.
You know, it's really hard to say. I mean, it's very difficult to build a large audience, particularly for hard news. And it's also very difficult to get advertisers to support hard news. So until you have a good business model, until you have a really big audience, you're just not going to do very well. That is my suspicion about what has motivated him to kind of change the way he's thinking about this organization.
I read his blog, and I got to the end of it, and I was still questioning, what's this all about? And then I read one of the add-ons or the a critique of it, saying that what's his name, Pierre
Omidyar,
is still looking for, is still trying to find his way, not quite sure what he wants to be when he grows up.
Of course, it's okay if you've made billions of dollars and you can put $250 million toward experiments. We'd rather have that money at our disposal than not. But I do agree with Esther. I think that we're going to find that these tech titans, we're glad they're in the space, but it's a really hard nut to crack. I think we'd also all agree that media organizations do need a much deeper understanding of their audiences, what they want and what they need, and especially when it comes to figuring out what kinds of editorial or advertising content will engage them. So I thought it was kind of interesting that the Wall Street Journal put together a little quiz this week to see what we know about consumer behavior and what advertisers know. It's called What Do Advertisers Know About You? You can go online and take the quiz yourself if you'd like. I just want to show you a couple of the questions and the answers and see what, if anything, this tells us. So here was question one. Who is more likely to buy suntan or sunscreen products, beer drinkers or wine drinkers? What would you think, Rod, would be the answer to that question?
I would think, what a silly question that is, and what possible deep meaning does this have?
But hold on. We'll get to the meeting. But what do you think? Do beer drinkers or wine drinkers, are they more likely to buy sunscreen?
I would assume the wine drinkers.
Okay, that's correct. And that's an insight that I think most of us would have guessed at. Here's the next question,
that's
Esther.
Insight.
Who is more likely to walk for exercise, ice cream machine owners or organic food eaters?
Let's let Rod answer. I know the answer.
Oh, that would have to be organic.
And that is
wrong.
Most people guessed that when they took the quiz.
I did.
But it's ice cream machine makers,
it is.
Right?
That's right, yeah.
Well, so Esther, a lot of advertising insights are less than obvious, right? So what does this tell us generally in terms of finding sort of new revenue streams for news? What can we learn from the fact that, you know, advertising insights like this are not always obvious?
Well, you mean what are the implications for
news? Yeah, what
are
the implications for us? I mean, obviously, it says something about the need to do research into what people's, you know, behaviors are as opposed to guessing. But what does this say about attempting to find out how to serve the audiences with these sort of new products?
Oh, okay, so that was not the question I was expecting you to ask me. But because, you know, those insights, although they sound silly, can be very useful for selling products.
Sure.
Can they be useful for news per se?
Well, news is a product.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. But I think a lot of the research that's out there really tends to indicate that, you know, we know who the hungry audience is for hard news.
Yeah.
It's wealthy people. It's highly educated people. It's old people. And so...
Mature.
You know, thank you. Yes, that's what I meant, Rod. You know, what do we need to know beyond that? I honestly don't know the answer to that question because we spent a lot of time trying to figure out what does a 15-year-old want from hard news and what does a 25-year-old and a 35-year-old want from hard news. And right now, I just don't think we know the answer to that.
But I think we would agree that the tools are now available for us, increasingly so, to get really inside the minds and, more importantly, the behaviors of people towards content, especially online. And I would think that we need to not take our foot off the pedal, so to speak. We need to really dive into the data that is available in hopes of being able to figure out what
Absolutely.
We can do with that.
But you know what's really – I do a lot of that. But what is pretty depressing about that is that the things we find out are so scary. Number one, people spend very little time with hard news.
Yeah.
They skim it online. They don't read it like they would read it in a newspaper. Number two, they spend a lot of time with, you know, buzzy news and that kind of thing and celebrity news. And so for those of us who think that if you don't know hard news, you're not able to be a good citizen in the United States of America, this is just not good findings.
Well, this is a good time to turn to some sort of celebrification of the news or some stories involving personalities. So I think we'll wrap up with that. So one content strategy that seems to work pretty well online is what we call the listicle, right? Those articles that are basically a little more than top 10 lists of things like the best dog name, or the worst dating disasters, and there's hundreds and hundreds of these things. BuzzFeed is one of those sources that runs on listicles. That's where they make a lot of their money. But they also have hired some serious journalists lately. So it was kind of bad news for them this week when their viral politics editor, which means the guy who does politics listicles, was fired after he admitted to plagiarism. There's an interesting debate about whether or not this is really a big deal. And Rod, I wonder, what's your take? If this online guy who creates these kind of silly little stories is fired for plagiarism, do we care?
First, I'll have to admit I've never even heard of BuzzFeed until now. I had read about
that. That's because you're reading hard news.
I am. And, you know, ink on paper. I had first heard about this particular case by reading the Washington Post, where that story showed up, by the way. As for the idea, as for plagiarism, obviously it's a no-no. It's a taboo. We in journalism abhor it. We condemn it. But at the same time, I'm asking myself, how many average readers give a hoot whether that particular phrase or sentence was lifted from some other story by another author?
Well, it's kind of it is the context, and the Washington Post columnist that you're talking about basically said that there is real plagiarism that we should worry about. And then there's this guy who's basically doing, I think, what he called crappy internet writing, and that's different from plagiarism. And in fact, Esther, even advertisers are looking at this case, unlike some other plagiarism cases, and kind of going, huh, who cares?
Yeah, I think it's a problem, though. I mean, stealing is stealing. You know, it doesn't matter if you steal, you know, something that's crummy or something that's very high quality. You still stole it, yeah. Right? So I think that's the issue. And I think, you know, when you have the dumbing down of news into a listicle of reasons not to move to North Korea and this kind of thing, right. Which is one of the things he plagiarized, you know, it's just hard to it's kind of hard to care about any of it. But I think we better maintain our standards about plagiarism, because otherwise anything you write down is likely to be stolen.
Yeah, I don't want to minimize my condemnation of plagiarism by what I said previously. As so many people say these days, I must have misspoken. But I probably copied that from somebody.
I must have misattributed that particular statement.
But at the same time, I do ask that question frequently. How many readers really care? How about the advertisers?
Yeah.
Do they really care that this appeared in a publication for which they invested in?
It doesn't appear so at this moment. Yeah. Esther, you talked about
it. I have to stand up for advertisers. Yeah. Advertisers who want to be in quality news publications would care. Yeah. Now, if they're in Buzzworthy, they're probably in Buzzworthy, not for high-quality journalism.
Well,
reasons.
So you talked about so BuzzFeed is dumbing down news. How about dumbing down sports this week? We had another journalist punished for bad behavior, Stephen A. Smith, who does commentary for ESPN. He's a co-host on this daily, quote, debate program called First Take. Well, on Friday's show, he was talking about the two-game suspension that was given to Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice for beating up his girlfriend in a casino elevator. Well, as part of his commentary, Smith veered off into a convoluted argument that women needed to be careful not to provoke domestic assault. Well, when called out by a bunch of folks, including some female colleagues at ESPN, Esther, he apologized, sort of, kinda, but ESPN did announce yesterday that he was going to be suspended for 1 week from any appearances on TV or radio.
Well, I'm proud to say I don't watch ESPN, but I was amazed at one of the bloggers who talked about their whole history of mistreatment of females, from harassing them to speaking disrespectfully about them to accusing victims of creating the violence against them, which this gentleman did. There's no excuse for it, and I think if women respect themselves, they should make their voices heard to ESPN, that this is just not acceptable.
And I would encourage you to read that piece from the Daily Beast. The headline kind of sums it up. We've got it linked on our blog. ESPN, the worldwide leader in pricks. So if you want to check that out, you can. I do wonder, though, and we don't have time to really get into it much, Rod, but there is this notion that kind of by dumbing down these debate shows where people are yelling at each other, kind of like on O'Reilly or anything else, that you can expect people to say stupid things.
Yes.
Yes. They said stupid things.
That's right. And that's how they build their audience, right?
Exactly.
It all comes down to one thing, and that is marketing.
We didn't have time to get to a couple of other things that I would encourage you to check out. Sarah Palin has a brand new online TV channel. And also a newspaper in Ohio got into a little trouble because they've invited Ted Nugent to perform at their summer barbecue. These things usually turn out to be, you know, good, feel-good events for newspapers. This one is not going to. That's going to do it for today's episode. Thanks for listening. You can find links to our topics under the programs tab at kbia.org. You can share your thoughts on our Facebook page or on Twitter. Our director this week is Pat Akers. Our student producer is Hope Kerwin. And thanks to Esther and Rod, of course, for their always cogent commentary. I'm Mike McKean. We're taking a break next week. Amy Simons will be back on Wednesday, August 13th, for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.